accession number 20254, Real 1.
John Gowan, Real 1. Where were you born, please?
In Hull. Do you want the exact address?
Okay.
I was born at 15 Hodgson Square, Sykes Street, Central Hull.
Which year was this?
1922.
Did you grow up and have your schooling in Hull?
Yes, I was. When I was in Sykes Street, went to Chatterhouse Lane School. And then in the 1930s, the whole area was put down for demolition, and our parents had the option of going up to North Hull Estate, which was just built, Greenwood Avenue, or coming to Barnsley Street. Of course, my father worked at the cement works in Dalton Street, so he picked this. So we've been here ever since, 1930s, 1 to 2, or whatever date it was.
And what did you do on leaving school?
On leaving school, I went as errand boy for a short while, for 1 year maybe. I left school at 1936, and in 1937 I got an apprenticeship as an apprentice electrician with a firm in Albion Street, which was virtually under the museum. And I was there for until the museum was bombed in 1940.
Were you there when it was bombed?
I was working there, but I was at home when it was bombed.
Can you take me through your memories of the bombing of Hull, please?
Well, we all had, along this estate, we all had Anderson shelters, which were directly behind the houses. And I was a bit handy, so I fitted electric light to ours, a ventilator at the back in the escape hatch, painted it, set it up, and me and my father, we built a blast wall in front of it, so it was very, very good, actually. And we had sometimes as many as 12 people in it, neighbours, coming, because it was so comfortable, they could sit and talk and ignore things. But myself and my father never ever went in the shelter, he always stood outside.
Why not?
I don't know. The fact that he suffered with his chest a lot because he was badly gassed in the First World War might have had something to do with it. But no, it was just accepted. He always stood out, keeping an eye up and round the backs of the houses, and I used to patrol up and down the street during the bombing. Very rare we took shelter at all. We didn't, anyhow, not really.
What were you both looking for?
Well, incidents probably. We had incendiary bombs, which we had the warden's shelter not far away. They used to come out and drop sandbags on them, or we did if it was handy. But the main thing was walking along after bombs had dropped, which they did pretty regular down here, walking along looking in the houses, because it used to blow the soot down the chimneys, and once or twice on the flats across road, for some reason, I don't know why it should be them, there was washing hanging on fire guards, which they did in them days, and it was on fire, so we had to, there was one or two of us wandering about, and we went in for it out, and that was it. I often think the people must have come back after the all clear and think, well, who's been in here? Because you never told them, it's just one of the things to do. And then
did you feel unsafe as you were going about in the bombing?
Not really. We felt unsafe. Well, we took cover, at least me and friends. There was quite a few of us, it wasn't just me. If we're going anywhere, we used to take cover in alleyways in the streets and the next street, Buckingham Street, there was machine guns going, because they used to machine gun as they went back home, junkers and that, you know. And they used to just go, but as they was passing over here, they either dropped what bombs they had left or machine gun, just for the fun of it, knock a few balloons down as well while they're at it. But it was frightening, obviously, to everybody, hear a stick of bombs running, which they did. There was one in this garden here.
In this house here?
In the garden, yes, and it damaged all these houses along here.
And this address is 7...
Oakwell Grove, yes. The bomb dropped in the garden. There was a big bomb hole there when we moved into this house at the end of the war. I wasn't in this house, we were further down the street in one of them.
What was the address of the house where this adapted Anderson shelter?
101. 101 Barnsley Street. And I must say, it was quite good. Quite comfy. And so, when the all clear went, which it usually did, well, at daylight more or less every day, because we had raids every night, almost every night, so they were either passing over or after the docks. Then I used to go and have a couple of hours sleep and then go to work, because I had a job as well. So it was a bit hectic, it was very hectic, but like everybody else, we all took it and got on with it.
What was the morale of people like?
Very good. It was very good. They went to work in the morning. The girl who eventually became my wife, she worked at Dairy Coats, which is quite away from here, at the tin works, sealing boxes of biscuits and stuff for the forces. They worked 12 hours, shifts, day and night. And every morning, if they was on at 6, they went out at 6 o'clock, come back at 6 at night, or went at 6 at night and came back 6 in the morning, irrespective of what damage there was. And they had to be there because it was a controlled job. They couldn't just leave or anything. So but it wasn't bad. The morale was good, actually, very good.
What was the attitude towards the German air crews who were carrying out the bombing?
Well, I don't think it was the air crew so much as the aircraft themselves, for some reason. I mean, you don't think of anybody being in them, you just say there's a donnery up there, and you don't think, he's going to drop a bomb. You think, they're going to drop some bombs. Different matter, I suppose, if you found any falling down, coming down on parachute. I don't know. It was a thing we accepted in the end, because we had it every night nearly. We had an air raid the air raid shelter became the place you went to on a night for 3 years.
Did you think the Germans would win the war?
I don't know. In retrospect, they should have done at that time, early on in the war, yes. Because I joined the LDB when it was first brought out. Then we made it the Home Guard. And when I consider what we did on our exercises, what we were supposed to protect, it was useless. I had a belt and a bayonet. Somebody might have a rifle, and that was it. And it was so crude, actually. But at the same time, we probably would have tried. If they'd landed here, we would have done our best.
What unit of the Home Guard were you in?
I was in it was called the BRCM, British Oil and Cake Mills, in Stone Ferry.
What kind of people were in that? Do you remember any of them?
Well, there weren't many youngsters or young chaps, because a lot would be called up. So they were all getting on. Mostly people who wouldn't be called up, put it that way, because they had to keep the mills going, obviously. So they were all getting on, really. There was a few of us youngsters who weren't old enough to be called up yet, but very few.
Did anybody have a rifle?
Oh, we did in the end. In the very end, we got one or two, but I wasn't with them that long then when I was called up.
Did you get any training with the Home Guard?
Oh, yes. They brought one or two weird and wonderful weapons out, such as a Blackguard, I believe it was called a Blackguard Bombardier, which was a small mortar mounted on a spigot that you just dropped on it anywhere, and it shot a mortar bomb out, if you were lucky. They didn't last very long, it was. And as for training throwing grenades, we used the weights off sash windows, broken into 3-inch lengths, you know, the weights of the sash windows. They were roughly the same weight as a Mills bomb, and we practiced with them, but we never did see a Mills bomb.
What kind of things were you guarding?
Mainly the road. Under the subways, because the railway lines go across the roads here, we had girders, holes in the road, so we could slip girders in, and big concrete rollers between them to stop all traffic if necessary, which we practice now and again on a Sunday.
Can you describe it again?
The barrier.
Yes.
It was holes in the road, drilled into the road, certain points, with girders in them, and then we had big rolls, like a big lawnmower, made of concrete, and we had to manhandle them in between the girders, so it would hold anybody for quite a while if they got to it and wanted it moving. You couldn't just push the rollers away because the girders were stuck in the ground. It was very crude, actually, but...
So the rollers were wedged between the girders?
Yes, you couldn't actually shift them all at once. Say a tank couldn't come and just butt them away. It would hold, and with it being raised above the road, it meant there was an embankment at each side, so they would have to go off the road, and if they wanted to come up, then they were exposing themselves. That was the theory.
What would the Home Guard supposed to be doing whilst the tanks or the vehicles were held up?
Well, I don't know, because we only had one practice with... Well, the tanks were Bren carriers, actually. A regular unit came, and we were just hidden about with bags of flour just to throw at them, but as I say, it was very crude and we'd no idea, but we would have tried, obviously.
Who was in command of this Home Guard?
Oh, I couldn't tell you his name. It was obviously, we'll say, a wax foreman, probably, or manager of one division, because there was lots of different divisions in the works.
Did you work for BRCN at the time?
I did at the time, yes. And we were bombed out there. So I went...
Can you tell me about being bombed out?
Well, went back one day and it was just... The part I worked in was flattened. Cato 2, they called it, was the name of the section. And there was nowhere else to go because the other works had been bombed along the river, which had been in most of them as they got bombed, they moved us. So they were concentrating us in the last one in the end. As a matter of fact, they just finished knocking it down now, the works. They've just not finished recently knocking it down. And from there, I went up to... went in for a hydraulics engineer course at Brough Aircraft Factory. And by that time, what would it be? It was 1940, end of 1940. And I worked there 1941, turning out Bother bombers, which were a torpedo bomber, testing hydraulics, like undercarriage and things. And I passed that, and I was posted to their works at Yeadon. And that was at the end of 1941. I was supposed to report in late January to Yeadon. But before that, I got my calling up papers in the December of 41 to report to Colchester in the January.
Can you give me the details of the job that you had with the Blackburn Aircraft Company?
Well, I first started being taught how to use a pop riveter and pop riveting the covering on the bomb doors of a Bother, which was very similar to a Blenheim. It dropped torpedoes though. It was a Navy plane, I believe. And then I went on to testing hydraulics as they were mounted in the frame. You tested them for pressures and put pressure in to make sure everything worked. The wheels came down, bomb doors opened and that. And as I say, I was there till late 41 and I passed the exam and I was posted to Yean. But unfortunately, I was called up before to report before then. And I had to go down to Colchester for January 1942.
How did you feel about being called up?
Well, it was one of these things that we accepted. You waited for your calling up papers because we took our medical exams and any other exams we had to do, and you just waited till you was called up. And of course, as soon as you was 19 or nearly 19, you got your papers to go report to a unit, unless you was reserved, which I would have been if I'd gone to Eden. And there were 100 of us altogether in the call-up I was on, who had to report to Colchester. One from London, 99 from up north, Yorkshire and Tantees, places like that. And we were sorted out, obviously, for a reconnaissance unit, which they were building up then.
What was the basic training like that you had?
It was very, very hard and concentrated. We arrived at a barracks, well, it was Nisnuts, at the regiment, at a place called Chadacre near Sudbury, which is Kent, I believe. And
Sudbury?
Yeah, Sudbury, near Kent. Is it Kent?
I thought that was Suffolk. Is it near Colchester?
It was outside of Colchester.
Well, I think it's Suffolk, actually.
Is it?
Or Essex, maybe.
And we were in Nisnuts, and in January 1942 there was a lot of snow. So for the first 2 weeks all our work was done in snow. Physical exercises in snow, press ups so that when you went down nobody could see you, you was in snow. Very concentrated teaching, and with all that, we also had to take gunnery, Bren guns especially, because we were going to be the gunner operators on the armoured cars. We had gunnery with the Bren gun, well, with rifle and other things like Morse code, which they taught us a Morse code, but in between that, if anybody faltered, they were thrown straight out. There was no argument, they were out. And in the end, I think they finished up with 33 of us who went into this squadron. And we had to learn to drive, map read, everything. Every man who was in going to be allocated to a crew had to know every other man's job, even to the commander's job. And of course, we got increments, sixpence a day extra for passing this, and radio, and Bren carriers, armoured cars especially. And then we were all sorted out in the end, so we had the drivers who were drivers. They could drive. They were the best. And gunner operators who had the Bren gun and operated the radio at the same time. Then the commander.
And so you were called the gunner operator?
Gunner operator I was, yes. And the tortoise, as I say, this Morse code, which was never ever used for the simple reason that all our radios never had a key. We didn't have any Morse keys to them. We never did use it.
What did they tell you about the Recce Regiment?
Well, it was it was something brand new in the British Army. They'd realised that if the Germans could fly about as fast as they could in these armoured cars and light tanks and stuff, why couldn't we? So there were the first armoured cars that some of the regiments, some of the older hands who'd been at Dunkirk, they were there in early 41. Some of them, they actually, their armoured cars were a Bedford truck with a concrete pillbox on, which is very crude, obviously. Then we had a small Austin 7 with a Bren gun mounted at the back. And then we tried different things until we found the one we wanted that was right. And it turned out to be the Humber Mark III light armoured car, which we preferred all the time, even when they tried to change it to, they gave us those American Greyhounds, six-wheelers and white armoured cars. We didn't like them. The Humber was a Humber Snipe. It was a private car, armoured. And it was so versatile, a good driver could turn it round on any road quickly, or reverse it quickly, which we had to do if you come to a corner and somebody fired a shot at you. And we found that they were the answer to us, no doubt about that. But as I say, we finally formed ourselves, and we used cavalry commands, that. So when we finally made up the squadrons for this, and the regiment was almost fully formed as a regiment, instead of bits and pieces coming together, we were with the 56th London Division, but because they were going to, they were working out this invasion to Algiers, for Algiers and Tunisia, and they formed the 78th Infantry Division, and they wanted a reconnaissance regiment, a full one. So we went to the 78th Division, but we kept our number 56th Reconnaissance Regiment. Whereas others, they had the division had the same number, the 5th Division had the 5th Reconnaissance, and so on. So we went up to Scotland. In the cars we went by road. Bren carriers went by rail. And we did our training up there at Carnoustie Golf Course, and then went abroad from Glasgow.
What kind of performance could you get out of these hunts?
They were good. They were virtually the prestige car before the war, you know, Humber Snipe. All the top people had them, and it was the same vehicle except that they took the body off and put armour plating on, put bigger wheels, run flat wheels on, and it was go as fast as you liked, near enough. And there was a permanent four-wheel drive.
100 miles an hour?
No, maybe not. And then days I don't think they had many cars, even the good cars that did much more, you know. Well, over 60, we could reach over 60 if you was on the road and charging about. Yes. Yes.
What did you think to the armament?
Well, it was most heavily armoured regiment in the British Army, because each car and each Bren gun had a Bren gun, rifle, Tommy gun. That was your three crew. Then the gunner operator had a pistol. That was his personal weapon. We carried a 2-inch mortar on all vehicles, grenades, mines, 1,000 rounds of replacement rounds, smoke discharger, obviously. Practically everything. You could make a lot of noise with one car. Oh, and a boy's anti-tank rifle with every vehicle as well.
What kind of pistol did you have?
Well, just before we were finally sorted out into squadrons, we got a box from the New York police. And all gunner operators had to go to the Nisnut. And we was issued with whatever came out of the box. So we had, when they opened the box, the police had handed in the spare weapons, pistols. I got a Smith & Wesson 38 and 6 rounds. Some got, well, more like cowboys, they had these long barrels on them. I just forget the name. There is a name from the well-known. All sorts of pistols that the police didn't use at the time, they sent them. So they had to modify the holsters, because they were just standard holsters. If you had a long barrel, you had to cut a hole in the bottom for the barrel to come through. But we didn't get... I only got 6 rounds, and I was only ever issued with 6 rounds, and that's all I had.
So you said you were up at
Carnoustie? Yes, Carnoustie. Carnoustie. We did some training there, mainly running along the edge of the estuary, I think it is, isn't it, there? Firing at balloons and that, just getting firing practice and doing things. And we're sort of settling in, then getting to know everybody and your mates, who was going to be your mates and who you'd be with and that. And
what individuals do you remember from that time?
Well, I had a very good friend in, I was in 15 troop of C Squad, and he was in 16 troop of C Squadron. And for some reason we clicked off, and I think the reason was when we first started our training, we were supposed to be attacking a point, and there were 2 rolls of barbed wire across, and the sergeant major said, "You're going to go through there." He said, you, that was the 2 of us, throw yourselves on that wire with your rifle in front of you, which we did, and the others run over us, which was an experience in itself. But from that moment on, we were real good mates, and we watched each other. If one was out on patrol during the war, on patrol, and the other wasn't, when you came back in at night, which was always late, of course, your cup of tea was there ready for you, and your kit was out. So it was a very, very good mate. But we're all comrades, of course. We all relied on each other.
What did you think of the NCOs and officers in charge of you?
Oh, well, with it being the type of unit it was, where your commander could be the officer, because there was one officer, there was 5 cars to a troop, one officer, so he would be in the middle car, 2 in front, 2 behind him. And we actually called them by their first names, John, Joe, what, Digger, unless there was other officers somewhere about, like, but normally it was, you call them by the first names, and they were all, they were all good, all marvellous.
What happened to you next?
Well, they gave us, all of a sudden, 48 hours leave from Carnoustie. Well, 48 hours was hopeless for the London chaps, obviously. I mean, especially during the war when trains didn't keep running. And we all got on the train and got to York Station. It took us about 3 hours to get to York Station, maybe a bit more. And it had just been bombed. So then I personally had to wait another 2 hours to get a train to Hull. There were no lifts, couldn't get a lift anywhere.
Have you any recollection of what York Station looked like?
Well, it wasn't as big as it is now. It was just a smallish station. It was a busy station. And all I can remember is the brickwork of what I took to be ticket officers was blown all over the platforms and that. And then it took another hour or more, hour and a half, to get to Hull. So by the time I got here, 12 hours of my 48 hours had gone. And then I spent the next day with my parents and the girl who she wasn't really even a girlfriend then, just a friend. And when it was time to come back, which meant I'd only had about 8 hours at home, if that. And then I had to be back again the same day, the second day, for 6 o'clock at night. You'd imagine it. Was talking and said, well, do you have to go back? I said, yeah. Anyhow, I put it back to the next day, knowing that I'd go finish up on a charge. But I thought to myself, well, these lunders aren't going to get back till 2 days later, which they didn't, a lot of them. So I was immediately put on charge as soon as I got back. And irrespective of the fact